This series is brought to you with the kind support of Wellington Management, one of the world's largest independent asset managers. Wellington believes in the importance of a diverse workforce, equitable opportunities for all colleagues to reach their potential, and an inclusive culture.
I would say that the LGBTQ plus community is certainly a minority group in the medical community. During my 4 years of medical school, I'll have to say I think I have less than 5 openly queer attending physicians. And the disparity is worse within surgery. I actually recently went to a Women in Surgery conference, which was celebrating women in the field. And there was actually only one physician there who had openly identified as a lesbian.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to this 50 Faces Focus series, in which we are celebrating LGBTQ plus professionals in a special series for Pride Month 2022. I'm joined today by Kate Barrow, who's a fourth-year medical student at Loyola. She lives with her fiancé in the Chicago area, however, will be starting her surgical residency in Ann Arbor, Michigan this June. She has a particular interest in colorectal surgery, in particular as anal cancer is a cancer that has a higher incidence in populations such as the LGBTQ plus population. Welcome, Kate. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Well, let's start by talking about your background. Where did you grow up and what were your early interests?
So I'm originally from Michigan. I was born there and I lived sort of in the Detroit area until I was about 12 years old. And at that time, my dad, who was working for General Motors, got a job in Asia. So we ended up moving overseas. I actually ended up spending 3 years in Korea, India for 3 years as well. And then I was in China for a short time before I came back to Michigan for university. Growing up, I was definitely a big athlete. The majority of my extracurriculars definitely surrounded sports, big soccer player, ice hockey as well. But I later fell in love with rugby, which I played in college. And other early interests included folding origami and also playing the acoustic guitar.
That is a really eclectic and varied range of interests there. How did then you come to medicine? Did you always want to study medicine? And what led you to that in particular?
I've definitely always loved science. Definitely was one of my favorite classes growing up in school. But I think my interest in medicine really began to kick off around the time I was in middle school and high school. Growing up abroad, I had the privilege to observe a variety of health disparities. And for those listening who aren't familiar with what a health disparity is, it's essentially thinking about preventable disease in disadvantaged or underserved populations. So when I would travel to different countries, I was able to see a variety of medical conditions, living conditions, and diseases. And I think that this really is what piqued my interest in medicine and global health and what really encouraged me to start thinking about medicine as a career. At least for me, someone who has always loved working with my hands, that also is what in particular started pointing me towards surgery. So coming into medical school, I knew that I wanted to pursue a surgical specialty. I just wasn't quite sure which subspecialty yet. So when I ended up rotating on colorectal surgery in my third year of medical school, I fell in love with it. And that's really what began my journey on my path to colorectal surgery. In particular, I absolutely love colorectal surgery because it'll provide me the opportunity to work with the LGBTQ plus community, specifically thinking about anal cancer, which is caused by HPV. And I think as a lesbian working with the queer community, this is so important to me and absolutely something that I want to incorporate into my future practice.
And it's so interesting because when we first met and you told me about your specialty and you told me about what you were hoping to achieve in terms of raising awareness by focusing on that, it was actually something that had never occurred to me that that was a cancer perhaps that had a higher incidence in the LGBT plus population. So let's just talk about that a little bit now. With this podcast series, we focus on minority voices, and we're particularly focused on the professional experience of the LGBTQ plus community and how inclusion perhaps is factored into professional roles. Can you paint a picture for the situation in medicine? How well do you think there is an inclusionary environment there?
I would say that the LGBTQ plus community is certainly a minority group in the medical community. During my 4 years of medical school, I'll have to say, I think I have less than 5 openly queer attending physicians. And attending physicians are essentially the bosses. These are doctors who have completed all of their training and are now just supervising residents or medical students. So they're sort of at the top. And I think I've met 5 attendings who have been openly queer. And the disparity is worse within surgery. I actually recently went to a Women in Surgery conference, which was celebrating women in the field. And there was actually only one physician there who had openly identified as a lesbian. Of course, this is just my personal anecdotal experience, but it really does seem like we are quite a minority in the field, at least in terms of raising awareness and having open discussion about sexuality. There is a national organization for LGBTQ plus health professionals called GLAMA. And I think that there is a growing presence of queer physicians, especially in the med Twitter world, sort of a sub area of Twitter. But yeah, I would say it's definitely, I think, a field that historically has been marginalized and has been a minority.
I'd like to ask just about two things that I just want to note also for our listeners, that we are a very inclusive podcast. So we're including the sound of your lovely cats there as well, which is we are delighted to include animals of all kinds to our podcast. But just in terms of inclusion, we see a big focus on this sort of in corporate life. I'm in the financial services industry. We also see it in the legal world, a focus on inclusion and specifically around ensuring that workplaces are inclusive and diverse. And it works sometimes and sometimes it doesn't. Is there even that focus, say, in a hospital setting or in a medical school setting? For example, might you see rainbow flags in the month of June? Is there a focus on inclusion? And then on the role model side, how important was it for you to have role models as you went through your medical training?
Yeah, I actually remember my first medical school interview, which happened to be at Loyola. I went into the admissions office and I saw a rainbow flag. And I immediately said to myself, I'm going here for medical school. And it turned out that other medical schools I interviewed at, I didn't see those flags. And I think it's something that I think we do need to work on more inclusivity and really working on awareness about inclusivity within the field. I think it's something that is definitely growing. There's a lot of medical schools who have student organizations dedicated to the queer community. But I think representation is something that we really need to focus on, especially when thinking about advocacy for our patients as well. In fact, when thinking about the education that we get, I think in terms of formal LGBTQ plus education, I think my medical school has a couple lectures surrounding LGBTQ plus health in the preclinical years. So that's the first couple of years of medical school where you're really learning a lot of the material, the biology, the pathology. I'm trying to understand how to diagnose different conditions. And I think that's a shame that we only have a few formal lectures on it. My university does have opportunity for students to rotate on a specific LGBTQ plus elective where you would work in special clinics, which focus on our population. But this is definitely unique and something that is not available everywhere. And I think when really focusing on our patients and physicians, I think that this is absolutely an area where we need more advocacy. And I think national organizations like GLAMA and such are really on the path to help raise that awareness. But when you think about it, I mean, there are thousands of doctors graduating every year who have limited education surrounding the LGBTQ plus community. And this is concerning and something I definitely want to focus on in my future practice.
And how about screening? Because I think you mentioned when it comes to anal cancer, not only is there limited research, there isn't even access to the screening that perhaps would be standard for other forms of cancer.
That's absolutely a good point as well. So anal cancer is caused by HPV, which is the same virus that causes cervical cancer. And I think as many listeners know who have vaginas, cervical cancer is very prevalent. And this is why we screen for it. It's astounding to me that we don't have screenings in place for anal cancer because it's the same virus that's causing it. And it's really the same sort of disease process as well. It's just in the anus instead of the cervix. And I think that this is, again, an area where we need advocacy. And a lot of it comes down to research is that we simply don't have a lot of data to support screening, which is why a lot of insurance companies and other national organizations are a little bit wary to put out formal screening recommendations. But I mean, this is an area that's extremely important and could potentially save thousands of lives. And when you think about access to care, the lack of screening is just an additional layer. And I think that it's something that, at least for myself, I'm going to be trying to focus on to help contribute to the research and encourage my patients who are at high risk to potentially try to seek out screening opportunities.
And how much do those patients that you know in the LGBTQ plus community face, say, bias or misunderstandings or just prejudice when they're trying to access care? And I think of another story that was told to me by another guest in the series who is a trans man, but would still need to attend a gynecologist for screenings. And simply the receptionist made him feel totally out of place in that setting. Clearly that comes from lack of education, lack of awareness. Have there been examples of that among patients that you know of?
Yeah, actually, a close friend of mine had an experience where he had unprotected sex and he went the next day to see a physician to obtain PEP, which is post-exposure prophylaxis, kind of similar idea to where it is a medication that is trying to help. So PrEP would be you would take the medicine before being exposed, and PEP is just you would take the medicine after potentially being exposed. And he was at, frankly, one of the most prestigious hospitals in the country. And the physician he went to there refused to prescribe him PEP. And when my friend asked why he would not prescribe it, the physician said that it was on the basis that my friend was a gay man. And this just absolutely is heartbreaking, thinking about the fact that there are patients across the nation who are having further barriers to care simply due to their sexuality.
And in terms of what we can do now, raising awareness, and clearly this podcast will hopefully contribute to that, what other things do you think are effective? Certainly more rainbow flags, more conversation, more role models. Do you have any other sense as to what other kind of initiatives might work well?
As physicians, I believe we have one of the greatest responsibilities when it comes to raising awareness and advocacy for our LGBTQ plus patients. We need to focus on educating ourselves so that we can therefore go on and educate our patients. As physicians, we have opportunities to attend conferences, educate ourselves, read research articles so we can stay up to date on literature. And so I think this will help us stay up to date on recommendations that continue to come out and that exist. And I think that this will very much contribute to the field and really helping to care for our patients. And I think in terms of other initiatives, I think organizations like GLAMA are a wonderful way to network and I think build a strong community for healthcare providers who are LGBTQ plus or allies. And I think initiatives through organizations like that also can be very powerful and have a greater scope as well.
I would also be somewhat encouraged by other initiatives to general increase equity in medicine. And even though we're a long way from rectifying that, I do think that perhaps COVID-19, as well as the murder of George Floyd, have raised awareness of some of the equities, say, across different ethnic groups. So perhaps when we look at equity overall, it'll be equity for all underrepresented groups, which may hopefully help with this issue of health disparities that you mentioned before.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that that's the future of medicine. And I think we just need to continue working on addressing disparities for all marginalized and underserved communities.
And I think you're going to have more and more allies in that respect. Just wanted to now turn to one other aspect of your own personal experiences around lesbian visibility, because we've had this come up in other podcasts that women in a professional setting are perhaps twice as likely to not be out as gay men, that there is an issue. There's even a lesbian visibility week. Have you seen that in medicine too?
Definitely. I think women in general have been historically underrepresented in medicine, and this has drastically changed over the years, fortunately. However, there are certain subspecialty fields like surgery where there still are very few women, specifically in senior or leadership positions. And I think when sort of extrapolating that to gay women, I think it can be considered in that sense as well, that I think if there are less women in general, certainly will be less lesbians or less queer women. And I think sexism within medicine is really deeply rooted, especially in certain specialties. Again, I sort of circle back to surgery and think that the culture is shifting. And I think as we have more women going into these positions and breaking the glass ceiling, I think it will definitely get better. But I think speaking from personal experience, I would say that gay women do experience a lot of difficulties within medicine that really any woman would. And I do think that we are less visible.
And when you speak then about challenges and maybe challenges you've experienced or setbacks you've experienced, were there any in particular throughout your career so far that you've learned lessons from?
I think the biggest challenges I personally have had to face actually is dealing with my testing anxiety. The medical field by nature is built upon a series of examinations. There are examinations to get accepted into medical school. And then once you're in medical school, there are countless exams, sometimes as frequently as every 2 weeks. There's board exams, subspecialty exams, relicensing exams. And so as someone like myself who does suffer from testing, this has really been a large barrier throughout my career. So yeah, I remember studying for one of my first board examinations, which was my step one exam. And I was just struggling to get a passing score. I had actually taken a practice exam several months earlier, which was to get a predictive idea of how we would fare on the actual exam. And I had actually done quite well on that practice exam. But I think a lot of that was because there was nothing at stake. I was simply taking the exam. But of course, when the time came to study for the board exam, my score went down after months of studying. And so I was really struggling to pass, and it posited a large challenge for me, especially when applying to residency, because I did end up passing, but my score was certainly below the national average. And this is difficult because surgical residencies rely a lot upon these scores to help filter out applicants. And so this definitely was a barrier for me when I was applying to residency. But after working with my school's academic assistants, actually with a therapist, and just my own resilience and self-determination, I was able to better handle my testing anxiety. And when I took the second board exam, which is step two, I ended up scoring a lot higher a year later. So definitely something that I'm still working to overcome, but I think it's heading in the right direction.
That clearly hasn't been a hindrance to your success. Thank you for sharing that, because it always seems with testing anxiety that you feel alone. Everybody feels alone because it seems like everybody else is doing just fine, which of course is the average. So it's important to share that. Speaking of advice and looking at perhaps any advice you've received over your career, is there anything that you can share or any creed or motto that you live by?
So my dad actually lives by the motto, never settle for mediocrity. Personally, I've sort of taken the spirit of this creed and expanded it to sort of live and especially work by these three values. I always try to have determination, adaptability, and resilience. And I think that these three are really important. I mean, in life in general, but especially in medicine, I think you need to be able to be determined to help your patients as much as you can, be adaptable for any situation, because sometimes you don't know what patient will walk in through the door and what barriers you'll have to work to overcome. And then resilience, because things sometimes don't go your way and you might need to think about alternatives and work with your team. And I think maintaining resilience during that is essential as well.
My last question is, any advice you would have for your younger self? Anything you know now you wish you had known, maybe as that student just coming back from your round the world trips?
I think advice for my younger self would be that sometimes you have to go down before you go back up. When you feel like you are having your largest failure, sometimes these biggest failures may in fact become the basis for your greatest success. And I think sometimes when you feel as though you're at sort of rock bottom, it can be really hard to gain that perspective. But I think there's always opportunity to learn from all experiences in your life. And I think that those can really become the foundation for some of your greatest strengths.
Well, thank you so much, Kate. It's been a pleasure to speak with you here. And when I see what you're doing today and think of what you'll be doing in the future, I see someone who's boldly going into an area that has had very little attention, very little awareness. And you are going to do so much, I think, to change that. And that's going to have such an impact beyond where we know even today. So thank you very much for coming here, for sharing your insights with us and helping to raise awareness.
Well, thank you very much for having me. This opportunity has been wonderful. And thank you for providing me the opportunity to share my story.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to our 50 Faces Focus series. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring professionals and their stories, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.